When the third pretty blue stocking made eyes at me, I left. Libraries always make me feel covered in ink anyway. Ink on my clothes, ink in my eyes, terrible. All the body heat in there is bound to make the pages mushy. My parents met in the library. My mother was a junior librarian, and my father's books were always overdue. He asked my mother's best friend what her favorite books were, and he took them out, one by one. La Dame aux Camélias, Thérèse Raquin, Madame Bovary, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Anna Karenina. He couldn't make head or tail of them. Hasty women, he told me, shaking his head. Hasty women. But he told my mother how much he enjoyed them. And when he got around to asking whether she objected to his calling on her at her family home some Sunday afternoon to continue their discussion, she didn't say no. I thought briefly about going to see my mother in her tiny apartment 2 hours' drive away, but I know she doesn't want to see me. And I know it's not because of anything I've done or failed to do. She doesn't want to see anyone. She's happy like that, I think. Always relieved at the end of a visit. I think she's too old to want to talk anymore. She doesn't mind listening, but she's got a radio set for that. She's still in good health. She's still got her wits about her. She had a lot more to say for herself before my father passed away, but then he was a fine man, great company, really great company, actually. Let you have your opinions and talked about his own in a way that never put your nose out of joint. And now he's gone, she'd rather not talk to anyone else. Solitary people, these book lovers. I think it's swell that there are people you don't have to worry about when you don't see them for a long time. You don't have to wonder what they do, how they're getting along with themselves. You just know that they're all right, probably doing something they like. Last time I saw my mother, she kept nodding and saying, "Everything's just fine, dear, everything's just fine." This was before I'd even made an opening remark. She was in such a hurry to get her part of the conversation out of the way. If I went to see my mother, what would I tell her anyway? I drove around instead. Just drove around, trying to decide where to stop. As I drove, I tried to think of a word, a single word, to sum up the way Daphne's been behaving lately. Inscrutable. The woman has become inscrutable. Take yesterday morning. Daphne was right outside my study, watering the flowers in the window box, warbling to herself, a pretty little racket. And I was somehow enjoying it and getting a little work done at the same time, and suddenly she stopped and said, "Well, St. John, you know what Ralph Waldo Emerson says." I waited quietly, held my pen still to show I was paying attention, braced myself for some cloying scrap of verse she'd just remembered from her high school yearbook. But she didn't finish her sentence, nor did she continue with the singing. So I said, "Go on, Dee, I'm all ears." She made a little moo with her mouth, blowing a couple of stray curls out of her line of vision so that I felt the full force of her stare. "What do you mean, go on? I don't know what Emerson says." "Oh, you don't?" I asked, and I laughed. She didn't laugh with me. "You know what Emerson says, St. John. That's why I said you know what Emerson says." Her sleeves were rolled up, and her voice kept going from flat to sharp. I got the distinct impression that she was steaming mad at me for failing to supply her with an Emerson quotation. "Can I ask, would you mind telling me where you got this idea that I know what Emerson says? Have I ever mentioned in passing that I know what Emerson says?" She yawned at me. "Come on, St. John, don't be shy. Tell me something Emerson said." I dropped my smile. "Did someone tell you that Emerson's a great friend of mine? Did the ghost of Ralph Waldo Emerson call one day when I was out and leave a message for me? Well now, Fox, my boy, you know what I always say?" "I really think you ought to know what Emerson says, that's all," she returned, without batting an eyelash. I stood up and went to the window. When I got close to her, she looked down at her watering can. "Mrs. Fox," I said, "you're a horror today." To which she replied, "Why don't you write a book about it?" Why don't you write a book about it? Why don't you... Speechless, I gestured for her to stand away from the window. Then I closed it. We looked at each other through the glass. She had this cool, triumphant smile on. She really felt she'd said something extraordinarily cutting. God knows what I looked like. Then she moved on to the next window box. What the hell am I supposed to make of a conversation like that? Then there was the picnic Dee and I went to last weekend. Neither of us wanted to go, but my publisher was hosting, and it seemed necessary to show my face. Some of the women had brought their little kids along to run around the meadow, singing their nonsensical songs and making daisy chains. There was this one girl with a pair of angel wings on. She actually had quite a lot going for her. She could whistle around two fingers, and she showed some of the little boys how to skim stones off the stream, and she didn't scream when water splashed her. I wouldn't mind having a kid if she turned out to be like that. Daphne was watching her, too, and scowling. At one point, the girl with the angel wings bumped into Daphne and said, "Sorry," real sweetly. Daphne just ignored her, looked straight ahead, tight-lipped. I told the child there was no harm done, but if I could have gotten a million miles away real fast, I would have. Then my publisher's wife, a new mother, offered to let Daphne hold her little boy. And Daphne looked at me with these eyes of mute suffering, as if asking, "Do I have to? Do I really, really have to?" I don't know what's got into her. Well, I guess I do, but it doesn't justify it. On the other hand, it was presumptuous of Ellen Balfour to think that every woman in the world wants to hold a 3-month-old baby just as soon as she catches sight of one. Daphne's right. It was presumptuous. Daphne held the kid, her arms really stiff, as if he could roll out of her arms and bounce off the grass and she wouldn't care. I checked the boy under the chin a couple of times and said he was a little prince, and he cried his head off. Then Daphne gave him back to his mother. Mrs. Balfour seemed to think Daphne was just overcome with delight and kept saying, "Oh, bless you, bless you. You'll get one of your own soon, Daphne. May I call you Daphne?" English manners. Daphne whispered to me, "That's the ugliest child I ever saw." "Bad stock," I whispered back, less because I actually thought so, and more because I've been thinking that Daphne and I should be allies. I want us to be allies, even when she's misbehaving. I got a laugh out of her anyway. Nothing's even happened to us yet. We haven't had a broke spell yet, or watched each other lose people, lose our looks, face down sickness. But Dee seems to be holding out on me, refusing to go all the way into this thing unless there's a child, too. Once I think my way past a lot of stuff that hasn't got anything to do with anything, the thought of being called Dad doesn't give me the jumps. Well, not as severely as it used to. I didn't used to think about these things. Huh, I must be getting older. Daphne could be onto something. But I won't be hustled into it. The other day, I went on an urgent mission to retrieve my wallet from a jacket pocket before Dee sent our stuff out to be cleaned. Dee had left a book on top of the laundry basket, "Happy Husband," that was the title, and underneath in smaller letters, "Make him happy, keep him happy," an advice manual. I took it away, read a few pages, chased them down with a couple of despairing drinks. There are real books all around the house, everywhere. She could pick one up, and in mere seconds she could be involved in something that makes her laugh and feel nervous and hot and cold and forgive the world its absurdity, Pushkin maybe, or Celine. Instead, she's spending her time reading up on what to do about me. It got me down. The book itself was useless, too. All the advice it offered about the timing of meals and affecting a cheerful disposition and trying to take an interest in the husband's doings, even when they're fearfully boring, and never saying, "I told you so." These aren't the reasons a person looks with favor upon another person. These are the reasons someone stays in love. I put the book back before she knew I'd seen it. If I said anything about it, she'd tell me I was taking it too seriously, that she was just looking at it for amusement. As for Mary, I'd been trying to get her to show up, but she wouldn't. I don't know what that means. Am I drying up? My book about the killer accountant is going as well as it can be, considering that I hardly know what I'm writing about. I'm just jogging along behind the plot like a cart horse, ready to drop it as soon as Mary shows up and it's time to get out of here. But no sign of Mary. She could be staying away deliberately. If so, I didn't know she could do that. Or my brain power is getting weak. Maybe once I'm alone in my beard, things will be the way they used to be with her. Friendly, I mean. I wrote her name in the steam on my bathroom mirror as a kind of invocation, and after a couple of slow minutes, I added a middle name for her, a kind of incentive, a step towards reality, bait. I wrote Jane, a good, plain, sensible name. Mary Jane Fox, I wrote. Before my eyes, the letters changed. The name grew longer. Aurelia. Mary Aurelia Fox. This is what it's come to. I pulled up outside a bar I'd been to a couple of times. I knew I could be kind of alone there, especially during the day when the social drinkers are waiting for the clock to strike a respectable hour before they start. There were a few guys inside, spaced well apart, one of them sitting at a corner table. He was groaning into his hat, but no one else in there even looked at him. I took another corner table, set down my scotch, lit my pipe, opened my copy of Metamorphoses, and pretended to read. The other guys started giving me the eye then, including the one who was wailing into his hat. "Gentlemen," I said from behind the cover of my book, "it's a free country." That had no effect. So I told the bartender to get them drinks, on me. There were only 5 of them in total. They left me in peace once they got their drinks. It was quiet until a bunch of youngsters swept in and started shouting their orders all over the place. I raised my eyes from the line I'd been staring at for the past 15 minutes or so and watched them. They used long words and called each other by nicknames that alluded to the classical world. Castor was present, and Pollux, and Patroclus, and Achilles. College men in town for the weekend. 3 of them had a muttered dispute amongst themselves before heading over to where I sat. They drew out chairs, turned them around, and sat on them. Usually it annoys me when people do that, but I wanted to know what they had to say. They asked me if I was S.J. Fox, and I said, "Yep." They named a few of my books and said they liked them. I said, "Thanks." They called their friends over and announced my name. Looking round at the faces, I could tell that some of them had no idea who I was, but they did an impressive job of pretending that wasn't the case. There's something to be said for good breeding. You get hypocrites out of it, but you get the odd respectful youngster, too. They called me sir and boss, and wouldn't hear of me buying my own drinks. I put my book aside and answered their questions as well as I could. These boys all had names like Toby and Jed, their real names, that is. They didn't try to get me to call them by their Greek names. They reminded me of Daphne's set, kids who had never been poor and never would be, spouting cheerfully lopsided theories. Men of the world who didn't live in the world, not properly. Me, I'm a farmer's son. These boys reckoned the Europeans were about to get into a scrap over Czechoslovakia, and that there'd be war again, and we'd be in it again. They wanted to know what I thought about that. I reminded them that Germany had had its balls cut off. Land taken, no army to speak of, no money. There wasn't going to be any war. I told them they weren't going to have to do what I did, that if they were looking for glory, they'd better find another way. "I hope you're right, Mr. Fox," Jed said earnestly, or was it Toby? Blue sweatshirts and ears that stuck out. "I hope you're right, but I don't think you are. Things are really boiling over. The Germans are saying all kinds of things, and France and England are running around trying to get promises. Didn't you hear? We aren't promising anything. Roosevelt said we're staying neutral. What's Czechoslovakia got to do with us?" Toby, or Jed, stared at me. "What's Czechoslovakia got to do with us? Well, what's independence got to do with us? Liberty, the pursuit of happiness?" All I could think of were a couple of lines someone else had recited to me a long time ago in France. To goodness and wisdom we only make promises, pain we obey. That's Proust, you know, the guy had told me. Daphne should have said to me, you know what Proust says. If she had, that little exchange of ours wouldn't have happened, or would have happened differently, maybe, would have ended without me having to shut the window in her face. The boys went quiet, which means I'd said the lines aloud. They were all squinting at me as if I was some figure in a fading photograph, and each of them was vying to be the first to identify me. A pox on the young. I left without saying goodbye. Just walked out. I heard voices as I headed from my driveway to the front porch. Daphne and a man. She was laughing. She sounded drunk. It was only 3 o'clock. I slowed my steps with a corner still to turn, hedges, luckily, so they couldn't see me. I heard the porch swing creak. The two of them were sitting on it. It was Jonas Pizarski she was with, and they were talking about fairy tales, of all things. Dee had a pair of scissors and a vase full of water and was arranging some flowers. Whether she'd bought them or he'd given them to her, I was sure the flower arranging was unnecessary. She always did it, stem by stem, even when presented with a bunch of flowers that already looked all right. Why have husbands got to keep themselves all locked up? That's what I want to know, Daphne complained. Not all of them do, Jonas told her. He wasn't drunk at all. I didn't like that. Those two sat together, his voice measured and sober, and her saying just anything that occurred to her. He was going to remember the entire conversation, and she would remember a quarter of it at the very most. Unfortunate. Oh, it's only the cold ones that do it, isn't it? I don't know about cold, Daphne. No, you don't know about cold. Because you're not cold, are you, J.P.? He didn't answer. Too busy trying to think of some phrase that would make her see him as ardent, I'll bet. You're not Bluebeard. Or Renadine? I caught flashes of Daphne through the brambles. She was examining her arrangement of the flowers from a number of angles. She didn't ask his advice, and I was glad she didn't. She always asked my advice, not that I ever give a response she can make use of. Nor Fitcher, no. Fitcher? Just what I was wondering. Pizarski seemed to know his stuff, though. He told me himself that he'd been studying for a doctorate in anthropology until his father had demanded he help steer the family's jewelry business. A diamond mine in Africa and a gold mine in Nevada. Opal fields in Australia and more. I don't mind to think about how rich Pizarski is. He doesn't seem to like thinking about it either. It's awkward that he has so much. What's left for him to want? He told my wife a bizarre story. It started out almost too screwed up to even be a fairy tale. It was all about a magician called Fitcher, who went around with a basket begging for food. And any woman who pitied him and gave him food was compelled to jump into his basket and go home with him and be his wife. Yes, Daphne said, laying down her scissors. I felt so sorry for him at first. All I wanted to do was make him happy. Yes, well, Fitcher did this with 3 sisters in a row. He said each of them the don't look in the locked room test. The first 2 sisters failed, of course. The only way for Fitcher's final wife, the 3rd sister, to survive her danger was by becoming insane. If you think about it, it was inevitable. That woman went through a lot. She found her sisters all chopped up and sunk in blood, and she collected the parts and she joined them up. Only a very, very young child would think of a solution like that, and only an insane person would actually try it. It worked, though. They came back to life, and she sent them home. On a clear afternoon in an empty house, she covered herself in honey and rolled around in a barrel's worth of feathers, and a skeleton sat by in a chair the whole time. It was meant to take her place, and she didn't hesitate or falter because she'd gone nuts. She was scared right out of her mind. She had to be, to rescue herself. So she stopped working to make sense of things, We don't always realize it, but it's hard work we do almost every waking moment, building our thoughts and memories and actions around time, things that happened yesterday and things that are happening right now and what's coming tomorrow, layering all of that simultaneously and holding it in balance. She cut it out and just kept moving. She was nobody. She was nowhere, doing nothing, but doing it as hard and fast as she could. And once she was fully covered with honey and feathers, she walked out into broad daylight and used the only words she hadn't forgotten. I'm a bird. I'm Fitcher's bird. If she'd ever been anyone other than Fitcher's bird, she didn't know a thing about it. What did she look like? All sticky with quills? What did her eyes say? Did she even understand the word she was saying? Never mind. Her mouth said, I'm a bird. I'm Fitch's bird. And nobody who heard her could doubt her. She met the bad magician. She met Fitcher himself on her way home. I'm a bird, she told him. He didn't recognize her. I mean, she was gone. He looked into her eyes, and there was no woman there. And he never caught her again. Daphne must have had a look on her face that made him stop talking. Neither of them said anything for quite a while. She went insane because of him, Daphne said. I think that's happening to me. The swing creaked again. I looked out from behind the hedge. I had to see what they were doing. If they saw me, they saw me. But if I saw that he had his arms around her, or even just his hand on her arm, I was going to bust his head open. The conversation itself didn't matter. She was drunk, and I knew what he was doing with apparent idleness, using his halting, mysterious European accent to feed her a story that he knew she'd like because she could place herself in it, be the victim, be the heroine. I withdrew before either of them saw me. You don't have to go insane, Pizarski told Daphne. It doesn't have to go like that.
What shall I do then? What shall I do?
She didn't sound as if she was especially interested in the answer to her question. Her arms were bare and freckled, her eyes were closed, her head was resting against the back of the swing. Mine. I wanted to lift her up into my arms and carry her around with me, our bodies together, my neck, her neck, her hands, my hands. He wasn't touching her, he wasn't even sitting close to her, and I could only see the back of his head. But he was very still, hardly seemed to be breathing, and he was looking at her. That was bad. Daphne, what's going on? He asked eventually. What's wrong?
I wish I could tell you, she said.
You can. You can tell me anything. He waited, but she didn't say anything. Maybe some other time. I think you should know, though, that there are other ways apart from going crazy. Do you know the story of Mr. Fox?
No.
Her voice was languid, reluctant.
What happens in that one?
The usual wing seduction, then the discovery of a chopped-up predecessor. But the heroine, Lady Mary...
Lady Mary?
Daphne asks. I didn't need to look to know that she'd sat up. Mary Fox put a soft hand on my shoulder.
Come away, Mr. Fox,
she whispered. I shrugged her off. She was wearing what Daphne called her signature scent. I disapproved, and not just because the scent costs enough per ounce for me to momentarily consider asking the shop girl to leave the price tag on so Daphne can realize how spoilt she is. Mary was Mary. She's been with me a long time, maybe even before I'd gone to France. She's handled a sickle at haymaking time, stacked and trumped the hay, helped me feed it to the cows and horses. She stood dressed top to toe in mud. And she's braced herself against the barn beams when she's been too tired to stand. Mary Fox shouldn't have anything to do with bottled fragrances. That farm stuff was before my time, Mary said. Come away with me, Mr. Fox. There was a hard smile on her face. You said that Mrs. Fox couldn't stop us, remember? Suddenly, I was getting to be a little tired of Mary Fox. "Drop it," I said to her. "Just be quiet. In fact, you can't speak. You've just lost your voice, Mary. You're real hoarse today." And I closed her voice up in my hand. Mary's lips shaped words. A fast and furious stream of them, but none of them sounded. She clasped her throat, horrified. She'd been forgetting who was boss. "Undo this," she mimed furiously. "In time," I mimed back. But the damage was done. I'd addressed her too loudly. Daphne and Pizarski had heard me, and they'd stopped talking. I couldn't stay where I was a second longer. I strode round the corner and stepped up onto the porch, car key dangling from my hand. "Hi there, Dee. Afternoon, Pizarski. Thanks for bringing her home. Had a nice time at the Wainwrights," they supplied quickly. "Oh, sure, the Wainwrights." Daphne got up and went into the house without kissing Pizarski goodbye. It bugged me that she didn't kiss him goodbye, as if now even a simple kiss on the cheek could mean something between them. Pizarski's leave-taking was good. Quiet, neither hurried nor labored. Good in that I didn't really even have to say anything to him, or look his way. I thought that if our eyes met, I'd have to take a swing at him. Daphne went upstairs, but not into our room. She went into one of the spare bedrooms and put her flowers on the bedside table. I followed her in. The predominant smell was mothballs. We haven't had an overnight guest for a long time. "Hi," I said. "Hi," Daphne said. She fluffed the pillows, pushed all the blankets onto the floor, and jumped onto the bed. "Like the flowers?" She flung out an arm in their direction. "They're okay," I said. "First prize for this afternoon's croquet?" "Pizarski won them, but he doesn't care about flowers, so he let me have them." "Good of him." "I'm hot," she said. "Could you bring me some ice?"
"Just ice?"
"Just ice."
"What are you going to do with it?"
"Look at it. Feel cool?"
"God, St. John, does it matter what I do with the ice?" "I'll get it in a second. What's going on?"
"Why are you taking a nap in here? Don't you like your bed anymore?"
"Oh, don't let's fight," she said.
My right hand was still closed up tight to keep Mary quiet, and Daphne looked at that hand for a couple of seconds, then at my face. I guess she thought I was making a fist at her. I wanted to ask her if she meant to spend the night here as well, but I didn't want her to say yes. It could be that she was in some kind of mood and just wanted a nap, and my question might force her to adopt a stance. She does that, I've noticed. She lashes out when she thinks she's been given a cue. "Is it okay if I host a luncheon for some underprivileged inner-city girls next Wednesday? Not too many, 5 or so."
"Fine by me. Got your underprivileged inner-city girl bait? Want me to drive you down to the city so you can catch 'em?"
"Be serious. I want to join B. Wainwright's Culture Club, and the luncheon is kind of an audition for me."
"That's fine. Just don't let him into my study. I mean it. That's off limits."
"Of course." She stood up before I could go and get that ice she'd asked for. "I'll get it myself, okay?" She went up on her tiptoes and kissed my forehead. Quite sadly, I thought. On my study desk, I found a brand new notebook open, neatly placed in the center. There was a list written on the first page. I looked at the list for a minute or two. Points in favor of D and M. It was almost my handwriting. So close, the first second it seemed to me that I'd made the list and forgotten about it. But I hadn't written it. These weren't even thoughts I recognized. So, Mary was writing things down now. I looked up, and she was laughing. Soundlessly, of course. She was even more appealing as a mute. Like an image my eye was chasing through one of those flick books, she wasn't moving. I was. I beckoned her. "You wrote this," I said. Mary came closer, gesturing helplessly towards her mouth. "Just nod or shake your head," I said. "You wrote this, didn't you?" She folded her arms. "Did Daphne see this?"
No visible response. I closed the notebook and laid my fist on top of it. It was starting to ache, vaguely, but with a throbbing that promised to get stronger. "This is childish, Mary. Don't do anything like this again." She curtsied wickedly and left me. I tore the list out of the notebook and ripped it to shreds. I needed both hands for that. Even if Daphne had found the list and taken any notice of it, she must know that I couldn't write a thing like this in earnest and leave it somewhere she'd find it. But Daphne knew something, or thought she knew something. That tiny kiss on my forehead, why'd she give me that? It stayed with me unbearably, like ashes at the start of Lent, the slap on the hand I got whenever I went to brush him away as a kid. I must have been 25 years old when I realized Christ never came back from the dead. Some people would say it wasn't a big deal, it was just that I wised up. But I'm talking about something I'd always believed until then. And damn near knocked myself flat with these new thoughts. I mean, the resurrection could be true. It could be. I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure, but it probably isn't true. So that means Christ was killed, and that was the end for him. He'd gotten mixed up with some pretty intense people in his lifetime, though, and those people thought he was too important to let go, and they made themselves important with this idea that their friend couldn't be killed, told everyone all about it, and hundreds died because they believed Christ couldn't be killed, and thousands more suffered. I mean, the martyrs. Think of all the martyrs. And I was walking down a street in Salzburg, eating an apple when these thoughts came to me, and I just kept right on chewing and swallowing, since it was something to do. Love. I'm not capable of it. Can't even approach it from the side, let alone head on. Nor am I alone in this. Everyone is like this, the liars, singing songs and painting pictures and telling each other stories about love and its mysteries and its marvelous properties. Myths to keep morale up. Maybe one day it'll materialize, but I can say it 10 times a day, 100 times, I love you, to anyone and anything, to a woman, to a pair of pruning shears. I've said it without meaning it at all. Taken love's name in vain and gone dismally unpunished. Love will never be real. Or if it is, it has no power. No power. There's only covetousness. And if what we covet can't be won with gentle words, and often it can't, then there is force. Those boys at the bar downtown coming round talking idly about more ideas to die for. Something terrible's coming, and everyone in the world is working to bring it on. They won't rest until they've brought it on. Mary, come back. Distract me. No, stay away. You're the problem. 31 Rules for Lovers, circa 1186, from The Art of Courtly Love by Andreas Capellanus. 1. Marriage is no real excuse for not loving, highlighted by Daphne Fox. 2. He who is not jealous cannot love. 3. No one can be bound by a double love. 4. It is well known that love is always increasing or decreasing. 5. That which a lover takes against the will of his beloved has no relish. 6. Boys do not love until they arrive at the age of maturity. 7. When one lover dies, a widowhood of 2 years is required of the survivor. 8. No one should be deprived of love without the very best of reasons, highlighted by Mary Fox. 9. No one can love unless he is impelled by the persuasion of love. 10. Love is always a stranger in the home of avarice. 11. It is not proper to love any woman whom one would be ashamed to seek to marry. 12. A true lover does not desire to embrace in love anyone except his beloved. 13. When made public,
love rarely endures. 14. The easy attainment of love makes it of little value. Difficulty of attainment makes it prized. 15. Every lover regularly turns pale in the presence of his beloved. 16. When a lover suddenly catches sight of his beloved, his heart palpitates. 17. A new love puts to flight an old one. 18. Good character alone makes any man worthy of love. 19. If love diminishes, it quickly fails and rarely revives. 20. A man in love is always apprehensive, highlighted by St. John Fox. 21. Real jealousy always increases the feeling of love. 22. Jealousy, and therefore love, are increased when one suspects his beloved. 23. He whom the thought of love vexes eats and sleeps very little. 24. Every act of a lover ends in the thought of his beloved. 25. A true lover considers nothing good except what he thinks will please his beloved. 26. Love can deny nothing to love. 27. A lover can never have enough of the solaces of his beloved. 28. A slight presumption causes a lover to suspect his beloved. 29. A man who is vexed by too much passion usually does not love. 30. A true lover is constantly and without intermission possessed by the thought of his beloved. 31. Nothing forbids one woman being loved by two men, or one man by two women. That nails it. I like this Capilano's fellow. M.F. Indeed. S.J.F. D.F. I stayed in bed almost all day Monday to see if St. John would notice, and if he did notice, to see what he would do about it. But he didn't notice. Didn't even come up to ask me about dinner. Too busy with his book, I guess. It can't be easy killing people off the way he does, especially since each death has got to be meaningful. I heard him on the radio once before I even met him. A fan of his called in, ever so earnest, asking him why some character or other had died in such a meaningless way. St. John's answer, "I was going to say that the meaninglessness of her death has a meaning in itself, but the truth is I missed that one, so thanks. I'm going to work harder." While he worked, he played a symphony I liked. He played it very loudly, but it was good that way, rising through the floorboards and welling up around me. I was lying on music, my arms and legs flopping down over a pillar of the stuff, my back the only straight line in me. If only my old dance teacher could have seen me, she'd have had a fit. I was always the girl who was just so. It was the easiest thing in the world back then. If I felt as if taking too deep a breath would make me fall flat on my face, that meant I was just so. There was housework to do, things to dust and scrub and polish and move around and fret over, work that has never been visible to anyone else, and I took great pleasure in not doing any of it. I spent a few hours looking at a book of watercolors that just happened to be lying around, but they began to make me feel weepy. They were so faded, the landscapes, and they reminded me of some I'd started and put up in the glass house, half-finished, because painting them made me yawn so much, and I didn't suppose that anyone who came out there for a cocktail on a summer evening would care enough to ask if they were supposed to look like that. They've been there 2 summers, and no one's asked yet. When it got dark, Mary Fox came and sat by me with a candle. I'd gone so dead in my senses and my brain that I'd been expecting her, and it was actually nice to have a change. She closed the door so we'd have some privacy. I didn't protest. "He won't be coming up," Mary Fox said.
He's probably going to go to sleep in there tonight. Again, I know.
She was naked and not a bit self-conscious about it. She didn't need to be. What I saw by candlelight made me sure that this was really going to happen. St. John Fox had dreamed himself up a nice little companion who wasn't going to get old. And he was going to drop me and live with her. She looked younger than me, a lot younger than him.
For God's sake, put some clothes on, will you?
I told her.
I don't know where they've gone.
I think I've annoyed him, and he's trying to punish me. I'm sorry if I'm making you feel uncomfortable. Give me any old thing to wear, and I'll put it on, she said, in a very simple way. No guile, no false concern, just honesty. I couldn't really be mad at her when she spoke to me like that. I got out of bed. Come on. We went to my dressing room, and I gave her a lilac shirtwaist to put on. I didn't tell her, but it was my favorite thing to wear. I'd worn it in Buenos Aires on the first day of our honeymoon. There it was, all over again, the first day, the first day, the first day. His hand in mine, all that woven into a dress. And there was no denying that Mary Fox looked as cute as a button in my dress. Its shade brought out interesting hues in her hair, or vice versa. I was glad we were the same dress size. It was something of a consolation to know that I'm nowhere near as fat as I sometimes think I am. Mary Fox sat in the chair at my dressing table, and I stood beside the chair, and she stared at me, and I stared at her. It was just interesting to see what St. John wanted in a woman. Her hair hung over her shoulder in a wispy plait, clumsily done. Someone should show her how to plait her hair. I wondered what would become of me. I didn't see him turning me out, not exactly, but I might be too proud to stay. He'd make me some sort of allowance, I suppose. I couldn't go back to my parents, though. Pops would forbid Maman from giving me a piece of her mind, and she wouldn't, not while he was there. But she'd give me that resigned look. Messed up again, Daphne, just what I expected. The look I got when I stopped going to college, only 10 times worse. I should fight this. Make some kind of threat. Greta would fight like a hellcat. Twice now, some girl has tried to get Bizarski to fall in love with her, and each time Greta's seen the girl off. She's not above fighting for her man. How do you threaten someone like Mary Fox, though?
I've never seen you this close up, Mary Fox said. I like looking at your face. It's a good face.
I couldn't help laughing at her formality. I wanted to say I thought the same about her, but I couldn't make myself do it. Greta would have risen up in my mind like a ghoul, sneering, "That's right, pay her compliments while she replaces you." I was always weak in the head, that must be it. I can't seem to care anymore about what I'm supposed to do. This is not a typical scenario.
What are you thinking about, Mrs. Fox?
Mary Fox asked. I laughed again. You're thinking of something funny?
He said you were British.
Mrs. Fox, she said, I think I'm more like you than not.
How can you know that? Anger began to kick in. How can you know that?
Mary Fox looked up at me with big, thoughtful eyes. I'm glad there isn't a stapler around. Abruptly, I asked her if she knew whether I was pregnant. I'd cancelled my appointment with the doctor. It'd be a bad scene if I was pregnant and a bad scene if I wasn't.
You don't look pregnant, Mary Fox said. Do you mean you don't know? If you don't, just say so.
I don't know. Of course I don't know. How could I know that? I'm not a doctor.
Oh, I thought you were magical or something, like a spirit.
She opened her eyes very wide, wondering at me.
No, I don't think I am.
Okay, not magical and not a doctor. Got it.
She was really too amusing. Now that I'd asked her if she was magical, I could see her wondering whether she might be magical after all.
What was this? Me finding myself wanting to look after this girl? Thing? Whatever she was?
What do you want, Mary Fox? my husband?
I believe in him, she said slowly. I wondered if she'd ever told him that, and if so, what he had to say about it. Someone you made up turns around and tells you they believe in you. What response could you possibly make? The scenario is just plain weird. And really kind of impertinent on her part, too. If it happened to me, I think I'd be speechless for the rest of my life.
I love him, she added.
That simple tone again. She thought this was something that was all right to say to me. That's nice. So do I. We sized each other up again. Mrs. Fox, Mary put a hand on my arm and we jumped away from each other in a hurry. The static, the awful static of her touch. It was exactly the way I imagined I'd feel if I ever brushed against an electric fence. My knees knocked together in a frenzy.
That caused an unpleasant sensation, and I won't do it again, said the little comedian across the room.
Good. Well, you were about to say something. Go on.
I wondered if you had eaten today.
No, I haven't. What's it to you?
I wondered if we could go out to dinner together, someplace fancy, and if I could wear a nice hat.
She wondered if we could go someplace fancy for dinner, and whether she might wear a nice hat? One of mine, I suppose, since there weren't any other hats to hand. For all her shapeliness, this wasn't a woman I was dealing with. This wasn't the M I'd pictured when I'd looked over that list of things in her favor. She seemed a girl, barely in her teens, mentally speaking. What if I worked on her a little, taught her a difficult attitude, and sent her back to her master with it? I know a place, I said. Let me just get dressed. She turned her back while I dressed. Then we tried all my hats on, and I got caught up in the excitement of taking someone new, a brand new person almost, out to do something new. She got the giggles, and so did I, so loudly that I thought St. John was going to hear from all the way downstairs and come up to see what was going on. He didn't. She decided on a hat, then changed her mind, and changed her mind, and changed her mind. Very indecisive about hats, that Mary Fox. Maybe she'd tire of St. John and slope off somewhere. Maybe she'd vanish the moment I set foot in the restaurant and asked for a table for two. How foolish I'd look. But I was prepared to risk it. I wanted to see a smile on her face. Some people make you want to see them smiling. And I like a project. I do like to have a project. After about 20 minutes of hat changing, I'd insisted she stick with the black cloche hat she had on. She pinned on a brooch of mine and moved this way and that so it glinted at her in the mirror, eager magpie of a girl. We rang for a taxi, and I let her give our address. She recited it carefully and looked so excited. She waited out on the porch, hopping, though she said she'd try to be patient, and I knocked at the door of St. John's study. "Daphne?" he called out, but not at first. He'd begun to say, "Mary," and stopped himself. I went in, stayed near the door. He dropped his pen and stood up, strangely gallant. What for? It was only me. "You're really something, you know that?" I told him. That wasn't what I'd meant to say. It just came out. It was the audacity of what he was doing and the fact that I couldn't fathom how the hell he was doing it. "Oh, yes? Well, so are you," he said, and looked admiring, turning his reply into a comment on the way I look tonight. Our exchanges always seem to turn into whatever he wants them to. I don't think any woman can get the better of him. "Keep things brief, Daphne, keep things brief, and you'll get up with your head still on your shoulders. This man is a deadly foe." "I just wanted to say I'm going out to dinner at the Chop House." "Great, we haven't been there in a while, have we?
Let me just finish my sentence, and oh no, you take as long as you need. I'm going with Greta."
"Oh, then don't worry about my dinner. I don't need feeding at all. I get by on liquor and flattering notices in the newspapers," he said evenly. A dark man, my St. John, tall and broad-shouldered and full of force he doesn't exert. I'm only just starting to see him clearly.
"Stop it," she asked me centuries ago.
inclined his head to show that he had heard. He mumbled something. Against my better judgment, I asked him what he'd said. "Just Greta?" "What do you mean, just Greta?" St. John sat down again, scanning the page he'd just been working on. As he read, he began to look baffled, as if someone else had snuck in and scrambled his sentences while he'd been talking to me. Wondered if she'd make Pizarski tag along, that's all. He attacked his page with short, exasperated scratches of his pen, crossing out. He didn't seem to like a single word he saw. "Oh, J.P., such a funny little man, isn't he?" I said. "So short and squat, and I hardly know what he's talking about half the time." St. John didn't stop crossing things out, but his lips twitched. I think he was happy I'd said that. But I felt terribly guilty because that isn't what I think about John Pizarski at all. I honestly think he rescued me yesterday and showed a sweet side I didn't know he had. And while it's true I'm not quite sure what he meant to tell me, it helped. It did help, and I'm grateful to him. I'd let J.P. down, I knew it, in the pit of my stomach, but I told myself he'd never know that I'd talked about him like that. I'd make it up to him. I'd read that book he lent me 6 months ago, and I'd discuss it with him and pretend it had changed my life. That thing he told me about Lady Mary conquering Mr. Fox just by telling him what she'd seen in his house, telling him right to his face in front of all the guests at that ghastly betrothal breakfast, and all Mr. Fox could do was stand there denying it, his denials getting weaker and weaker as her story got more detailed. "I know what you're doing. I know what you are." She had power after that, the knowing and the telling, power to walk away or stay, save his life, order his death. I don't know what I'd have done in her place. It's easier to picture Greta in that kind of situation. Greta would have blackmailed him for sure, just for fun and pocket change. Mary caused quite a stir at dinner, and I was glad to be there. She was a little sad to have to take the hat off indoors, but she ate and drank and touched the knives and forks and spoons and her wine glass with such delight you couldn't help but watch her. And she watched everyone and told me what she thought of them. A group of four men moved tables so that they were in our line of vision, and whenever Mary looked over at them, they toasted her. She got quite mischievous about it and made them drop their cutlery at least 10 times as they scrambled to lift their glasses. "It's kind of like a jack-in-the-box," she said. She was blushing because of all the attention, her cheeks a gorgeous shade of pink, and I said, quoting something I'd read, "Modesty is more effective than the most expensive rouge." Then I realized I hadn't read it anywhere, and I just made it up. "Modesty is more effective than the most expensive rouge," I said again. "Hey, you should put that in your book," Mary said with a smile of approval. Two couples St. John and I knew, the Comins and the Nesbitts, came over to say hello and get an eyeful. I introduced Mary to them as a second cousin of St. John's, which seemed to satisfy them, and they shook hands with her without any difficulty, though I was very worried that there would be. Mrs. Nesbitt is the yelling kind, and alarming her in any way is a surefire route to notoriety. The Nesbitts and the Comins were as nosy as they could be in a few brief minutes, and Mary told them she'd just come out of finishing school in Boston. She was a fluent liar, and really warm with it, really personal. If I hadn't seen her come to life before my very eyes, I'd have believed her. "You must come to dinner next week," Mrs. Nesbitt said, before they left the restaurant, and Mary said she'd absolutely adore it too. I began to foresee a disgustingly sociable future, then tried to see the three of us out for the evening, Mary, St. John, and I, and that jarred me out of my speculation. "Mary, what was that about a book? What do you mean, my book?" Mary poured us both more wine, fixed me with a suddenly keen gaze. "Aren't you going to write one?" "I'd won a couple of prizes for essays and things at school, and a prize for a short story, but that was also long ago. And it wasn't hard to shine at that sort of thing at my school. No one really studied hard, because it was so unnecessary when you were going to marry well. Even so, maybe I would try. It could well go the way of the watercolor paintings and the clay pottery and the botany, but